Chapter 25. The law writer, on the eastern borders of Chancery Lane, that is to say, more particularly in Cook's Court, Cursitor Street, Mr. Snagsby, law stationer, pursues his lawful calling. In the shade of Cook's Court, at most times a shady place, Mr. Snagsby has dealt in all sorts of blank forms of legal process, in skins and rolls of parchment, in paper fool's cap, brief, draft, brown, white, whitey brown, and blotting, in stamps, in office quills, pens, ink, india rubber, pounce, pins, pencils, sealing wax, and wafers, in red tape and green ferret, in pocketbooks, almanacs, diaries, and law lists, in string boxes, rulers, inkstands, glass and leaden pen knives, scissors, bodkins, and other small office cutlery, in short, in articles too numerous to mention, ever since he was out of his time, and went into partnership with Pepper. On that occasion, Cook's Court was in a manner revolutionized by the new inscription in fresh paint, Pepper and Snagsby, displacing the time-honored, and not easily to be deciphered legend Pepper only. For smoke, which is the London ivy, had so wreathed itself round Pepper's name, and clung to his dwelling place, that the affectionate parasite quite overpowered the parent tree. Pepper is never seen in Cook's Court now. He is not expected there, for he has been recumbent this quarter of a century in the churchyard of St. Andrew's, Holborn, with the wagons and hackney coaches roaring past him all the day, and half the night like one great dragon. If he ever steal forth, when the dragon is at rest, to air himself again in Cook's Court until admonished to return by the crowing of the sanguine cock in the cellar at the little dairy in Cursitor Street, whose ideas of daylight it would be curious to ascertain, since he knows from his personal observation next to nothing about it, if Pepper ever do revisit the pale glimpses of Cook's Court, which no law stationer in the trade can positively deny, he comes invisibly, and no one is the worse or wiser. In his lifetime, and likewise in the period of Snagsby's time of 7 long years, there dwelt with Pepper in the same law stationering premises a niece, a short, shrewd niece, something too violently compressed about the waist, and with a sharp nose like a sharp autumn evening, inclining to be frosty towards the end. The Cook's courtiers had a rumor flying among them, that the mother of this niece did, in her daughter's childhood, moved by too jealous a solicitude, that her figure should approach perfection, lace her up every morning with her maternal foot against the bedpost for a stronger hold and purchase, and further, that she exhibited internally pints of vinegar and lemon juice, which acids, they held, had mounted to the nose and temper of the patient. With whichsoever of the many tongues of rumor this frothy report originated, it either never reached, or never influenced the ears of young Snagsby, who, having wooed and won its fair subject on his arrival at man's estate, entered into two partnerships at once. So now, in Cook's Court, Cursitor Street, Mr. Snagsby and the niece are one, and the niece still cherishes her figure, which, however tastes may differ, is unquestionably so far precious, that there is mighty little of it. Mr. and Mrs. Snagsby are not only one bone and one flesh, but, to the neighbor's thinking, one voice too. That voice, appearing to proceed from Mrs. Snagsby alone, is heard in Cook's Court very often. Mr. Snagsby, otherwise than as he finds expression through these dulcet tones, is rarely heard. He is a mild, bald, timid man with a shining head, and a scrubby clump of black hair sticking out at the back. He tends to meekness and obesity. As he stands at his door in Cook's Court in his gray shop coat and black calico sleeves, looking up at the clouds, or stands behind a desk in his dark shop with a heavy flat ruler, snipping and slicing at sheepskin in company with his two prentices, he is emphatically a retiring and unassuming man. From beneath his feet, at such times, as from a shrill ghost unquiet in its grave, there frequently arise complainings and lamentations in the voice already mentioned. And haply, on some occasions when these reach a sharper pitch than usual, Mr. Snagsby mentions to the prentices, "I think my little woman is a-giving it to Guster." this proper name, so used by Mr. Snagsby, as before now sharpened the wit of the cook's courtiers to remark that it ought to be the name of Mrs. Snagsby, seeing that she might with great force and expression be termed a guster, in compliment to her stormy character. It is, however, the possession, and the only possession except 50 shillings per annum, and a very small box indifferently filled with clothing, of a lean young woman from a workhouse by some supposed to have been christened Augusta, who, although she was farmed or contracted for during her growing time by an amiable benefactor of his species resident at Tooting, and cannot fail to have been developed under the most favorable circumstances, has fits, which the parish can't account for. Guster, really aged 23 or 24, but looking around 10 years older, goes cheap with this unaccountable drawback of fits, and is so apprehensive of being returned on the hands of her patron saint, that except when she is found with her head in the pail, or the sink, or the copper, or the dinner, or anything else, that happens to be near her at the time of her seizure, she is always at work. She is a satisfaction to the parents and guardians of the prentices, who feel that there is little danger of her inspiring tender emotions in the breast of youth. She is a satisfaction to Mrs. Snagsby, who can always find fault with her. She is a satisfaction to Mr. Snagsby, who thinks it a charity to keep her. The law stationer's establishment is, in Guster's eyes, a temple of plenty and splendor. She believes the little drawing room upstairs, always kept, as one may say, with its hair in papers and its pinafore on, to be the most elegant apartment in Christendom. The view it commands of Cook's Court at one end, not to mention a squint into Cursitor Street, and of Covence's the sheriff's officer's backyard at the other, she regards as a prospect of unequaled beauty. The portraits it displays in oil and plenty of it too, of Mr. Snagsby looking at Mrs. Snagsby, and of Mrs. Snagsby looking at Mr. Snagsby, are in her eyes as achievements of raffle or titian. Guster has some recompenses for her many privations. Mr. Snagsby refers everything not in the practical mysteries of the business to Mrs. Snagsby. She manages the money, reproaches the tax gatherers, appoints the times and places of devotion on Sundays, licenses Mr. Snagsby's entertainments, and acknowledges no responsibility as to what she thinks fit to provide for dinner, insomuch that she is the high standard of comparison among the neighboring wives a long way down Chancery Lane on both sides, and even out in Holborn, who in any domestic passages of arms habitually call upon their husbands to look at the difference between their the wives' position and Mrs. Snagsby's, and their the husbands' behavior and Mr. Snagsby's. Rumor, always flying bat-like about Cook's Court and skimming in and out at everybody's windows, does say that Mrs. Snagsby is jealous and inquisitive, and that Mr. Snagsby is sometimes worried out of house and home, and that if he had the spirit of a mouse he wouldn't stand it. It is even observed that the wives who quote him to their self-willed husbands as a shining example in reality look down upon him, and that nobody does so with greater superciliousness than one particular lady whose lord is more than suspected of laying his umbrella on her as an instrument of correction. But these vague whisperings may arise from Mr. Snagsby's being in his way rather a meditative and poetical man, loving to walk in Staple Inn in the summer time, and to observe how counterfeit the sparrows and the leaves are, also to lounge about the Rolls Yard of a Sunday afternoon, and to remark, if in good spirits, that there were old times once, and that you'd find a stone coffin or two now under that chapel, he'll be bound, if he was to dig for it. He solaces his imagination too, by thinking of the many chancellors and vices, and masters of the rolls who are deceased, and he gets such a flavor of the country out of telling the two prentices how he has heard say that a brook as clear as crystal once ran right down the middle of Holborn, when turnstile really was a turnstile, leading slap away into the meadows, gets such a flavor of the country out of this, that he never wants to go there. The day is closing in and the gas is lighted, but is not yet fully effective, for it is not quite dark. Mr. Snagsby, standing at his shop door looking up at the clouds, sees a crow who is out late skim westward over the slice of sky belonging to Cook's Court. The crow flies straight across Chancery Lane and Lincoln's Inn Garden into Lincoln's Inn Fields. Here, in a large house, formerly a house of state, lives Mr. Tulkinghorn. It is let off in sets of chambers now, and in those shrunken fragments of its greatness, lawyers lie like maggots in nuts. But its roomy staircases, passages, and antecumers still remain, and even its painted ceilings, where allegory, in Roman helmet and celestial linen, sprawls among balustrades and pillars, flowers, clouds, and big-legged boys, and makes the headache as would seem to be allegory's object always, more or less. Here, among his many boxes labeled with transcendent names, lives Mr. Tulkinghorn, when not speechlessly at home in country houses, where the great ones of the earth are bored to death. Here he is today, quiet at his table, an oyster of the old school whom nobody can open. Like as he is to look at, so is his apartment in the dusk of the present afternoon. Rusty, out of date, withdrawing from attention, able to afford it. Heavy, broad-backed, old-fashioned, mahogany and horsehair chairs, not easily lifted. Obsolete tables with spindle legs and moldy baize covers. Presentation prints of the holders of great titles, in the last generation or the last but one, environ him. A thick and dingy Turkey carpet muffles the floor where he sits, attended by two candles in old-fashioned silver candlesticks that give a very insufficient light to his large room. The titles on the backs of his books have retired into the binding. Everything that can have a lock has got one. No key is visible. Very few loose papers are about. He has some manuscript near him, but is not referring to it. With the round top of an inkstand, and two broken bits of sealing wax, he is silently and slowly working out whatever train of indecision is in his mind. Now the inkstand top is in the middle, now the red bit of sealing wax, now the black bit. That's not it. Mr. Tulkinghorn must gather them all up and begin again. Here, beneath the painted ceiling, with foreshortened allegory staring down at his intrusion, as if it meant to swoop upon him, and he cutting it dead, Mr. Tulkinghorn has at once his house and office. He keeps no staff, only one middle-aged man, usually a little out at elbows, who sits in a high pew in the hall, and is rarely overburdened with business. Mr. Tulkinghorn is not in a common way. He wants no clerks. He is a great reservoir of confidences, not to be so tapped. His clients want him. He is all in all. Drafts that he requires to be drawn are drawn by special pleaders in the temple on mysterious instructions. Fair copies that he requires to be made are made at the stationer's, expense being no consideration. The middle-aged man in the pew knows scarcely more of the affairs of the peerage than any crossing sweeper in Holborn. The red bit, the black bit, the inkstand top, the other inkstand top, the little sandbox. So, you to the middle, you to the right, you to the left. This train of indecision must surely be worked out now or never. Now, Mr. Tulkinghorn gets up, adjusts his spectacles, puts on his hat, puts the manuscript in his pocket, goes out, tells the middle-aged man out at elbows, "I shall be back presently." Very rarely tells him anything more explicit. Mr. Tulkinghorn goes, as the crow came not quite so straight, but nearly to Cook's Court, Cursitor Street, to Snagsby's, law stationers, deeds engrossed and copied, law writing executed in all its branches, and C, it is somewhere about 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and a balmy fragrance of warm tea hovers in Cook's Court. It hovers about Snagsby's door. The hours are early there. Dinner at 1:30 and supper at 9:30. Mr. Snagsby was about to descend into the subterranean regions to take tea when he looked out of his door just now and saw the crow who was out late. Master at home? Guster is minding the shop, for the prentices take tea in the kitchen with Mr. and Mrs. Snagsby, Consequently, the robe maker's two daughters, combing their curls at the two glasses in the two second floor windows of the opposite house, are not driving the two apprentices to distraction as they fondly suppose, but are merely awakening the unprofitable admiration of Guster, whose hair won't grow, and never would, and it is confidently thought, never will. Master at home? Says Mr. Tulkinghorn. Master is at home, and Guster will fetch him. Guster disappears, glad to get out of the shop, which he regards with mingled dread and veneration as a storehouse of awful implements of the great torture of the law, a place not to be entered after the gas is turned off. Mr. Snagsby appears, greasy, warm, herbaceous, and chewing. Bolts a bit of bread and butter. Says, bless my soul, sir. Mr. Tulkinghorn. I want half a word with you, Snagsby. Certainly, sir. Dear me, sir, why didn't you send your young man round for me? Pray walk into the back shop, sir. Snagsby has brightened in a moment. The confined room, strong of parchment grease, is warehouse, counting house, and copying office. Mr. Tulkinghorn sits, facing round, on a stool at the desk. Jarndyce and Jarndyce, Snagsby. Yes, sir. Mr. Snagsby turns up the gas and coughs behind his hand, modestly anticipating profit. Mr. Snagsby, as a timid man, is accustomed to cough with a variety of expressions, and so to save words. You copied some affidavits in that cause for me lately. Yes, sir, we did. There was one of them, says Mr. Tulkinghorn, carelessly feeling tight, an openable oyster of the old school. In the wrong coat pocket, the handwriting of which is peculiar, and I rather like. As I happened to be passing, and thought I had it about me, I looked in to ask you, but I haven't got it. No matter, any other time will do. Ah, here it is. I looked in to ask you who copied this. Who copied this, sir? Says Mr. Snagsby, taking it, laying it flat on the desk, and separating all the sheets at once with a twirl, and a twist of the left hand peculiar to law stationers. We gave this out, sir. We were giving out rather a large quantity of work just at that time. I can tell you in a moment who copied it, sir, by referring to my book. Mr. Snagsby takes his book down from the safe, makes another bolt of the bit of bread and butter which seemed to have stopped short, eyes the affidavit aside, and brings his right forefinger traveling down the page of the book, Juby Packer Jarndyce. Jarndyce. Here we are, sir, says Mr. Snagsby. To be sure. I might have remembered it. This was given out, sir, to a writer who lodges just over on the opposite side of the lane. Mr. Tulkinghorn has seen the entry, found it before the law stationer, read it while the forefinger was coming down the hill. What do you call him? Nemo? Says Mr. Tulkinghorn. Nemo, sir. Here it is. 42 folio. Given out on the Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, brought in on the Thursday morning at 9:30. Nemo. Repeats Mr. Tulkinghorn. Nemo is Latin for no one. It must be English for someone, sir, I think, Mr. Snagsby submits with his deferential cough. It is a person's name. Here it is, you see, sir. 42 folio. Given out Wednesday night, 8 o'clock. Brought in Thursday morning, 9:30. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.